This is one of a series of tape slide talks on electroluminescence and semiconductor lasers, recorded May 11, 1966, at Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. The seminar was organized by Gerald J. Herskowitz, Carl Conarth, and Elliot Schlamm of the Basic Sciences Committee of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York Section. A recorded voice interspersed with the speaker will give numbers corresponding to the numbered slides accompanying this recording. Begin by projecting slide 0, the title slide, now. Our next speaker will talk on defect chemistry and injection electroluminescence in wide band gap 2-6 compounds. He is Dr. Manuel Avin of the General Electric Research Laboratories, Schenectady, New York. Slide 0A.
The story of luminescence in 2-6 compounds is full of contrasts. Take, for example, the green luminescent copper-activated zinc sulfide phosphor that all of you must know from luminous watch dials, TV, X-ray or oscilloscope screens, electroluminescent night lights, and many similar products. Well, this phosphor has been investigated now over 100 years. It's so simple to prepare that it's often used in junior high science projects, and yet up to this day, we don't know what the configuration of the luminescent center is that's responsible for this emission. Another example is from the area of injection electroluminescence. We in 2-6 compounds started thinking about injection EL about 12 to 15 years ago, when few people even knew of the existence of 3-5 compounds. And one of the first U.S. patents written for the injection EL process, owned by Lebner, who was then at RCA, is written, believe it or not, in terms of a p-n junction in zinc sulfide. So if it ever becomes commercially important, that's what we have to contend with. And what happened then? You see, the 3-5 compounds came from way behind, and as we heard this morning, they have the injection electroluminescent well in hand. In fact, it has been developed to the ultimate stage of this process, you might say, in the form of the injection EL lasers. And in 2-6 compounds, we are yet to make a single p-n junction emitter from that would emit an invisible part of the spectrum.
Slide 0B.
Now, maybe these two examples are sufficient to elicit the question from you, why on earth do we bother about 2-6 compounds if it's so tough? Well, one answer to this question is obvious. When there is at least an operationally definable physical process that we don't understand, this is not a reason for scientists to get discouraged. Just the other way around, this acts as a stimulus to try to find out what's wrong. And so, in 2-6 compound work, many very interesting physical and chemical principles have emerged as people have worked in this field for these years. The second point is that the 2-6 compound phosphors are about the most efficient room temperature emitters, and they are commercially quite important, amounting to between $5 and $10 million yearly sales. Third reason, applying specifically to injection electroluminescence, is that the 3-5 compounds as yet don't cover the short wavelength end of the visible spectrum or the near ultraviolet. And so the wide band gap 2-6s, along with the as yet not very thoroughly investigated 3-5s, like for example aluminum nitride, and few other compounds like diamond or silicon carbide, are about equally promising or unpromising for this application.
Slide 1.
Well, let's get acquainted with our cast of characters on the first slide here. Formally, you can regard a much larger group of materials as 2-6 compounds, things like cadmium sulfide, cadmium oxide, zinc oxide, mercury, tellurides, selenides, and polonides, and so forth. But it is usually these six that are referred to as the zinc sulfide family of compounds, or simply 2-6 compounds. Now, starting from bottom, we have here cadmium telluride, which has a band gap very close to that of gallium arsenide. And this is the only 2-6 compound that can be made in both low resistivity N and P-type forms, And as Dr. Ivy mentioned this morning, the IBM group, headed now by Fred Moorhead, have demonstrated very efficient injection electroluminescence from gallium telluride p-n junction, about 12% external at 77 degrees. But the title of my talk says injection EL and so forth in wide bandgap 2,6 compounds. So what I say, I would like to confine mainly to the compounds that have their bandgaps in a visible part of the spectrum, which are the other four or five. Now, you will notice immediately when you look in this column of resistivities that zinc sulfide, cadmium sulfide, zinc sulfide, zinc selenide, cadmium sulfide, and cadmium selenide can be made only in low resistivity n-type form, the p-type forms being either non-existent or very high resistivity, and zinc telluride can be made only in low resistivity p-type form, the n-type form being of very high resistivity. So right off the bat here, we know we cannot make a p-n junction out of any of these compounds as yet. The question is why not, and what can we do if we can't obtain injection EL by a simple binary compound p-n junction? Let's take the why first. Well, 2,6 compounds can be, in many cases, but by no means all cases, doped by the same techniques as used in silicon germanium and the 3,5s. If you want to produce n-type conductivity, you try to diffuse in an element from the periodic system which lies one column to the right of the element of the parent compound you replace. In silicon, it would be, say, arsenic. In gallium arsenide, it would be tin replacing arsenic, or tellurium replacing, tin replacing gallium, or tellurium replacing arsenic. In a 2,6 compound like zinc sulfide, it may be aluminum replacing zinc, or chlorine replacing sulfur. And the next slide,
slide 2,
will show on a very simple way that diffusing in aluminum, which has one more outer electron than zinc, we will achieve a situation where all the bonds are satisfied and one electron is left over. This goes into a large hydrogenic orbit around the positive aluminum core, or saying it in other words, we are introducing a hydrogenic donor level near the conduction band edge at room temperatures. These are mostly ionized, and we have our n-type conductivity, if we are lucky. But now, in 2,6 compounds, another type of defect can occur, either intentionally or unintentionally, as shown on the next slide.
Slide 3.
And this is a native defect. You see, now zinc may be ejected without putting anything into the place where it came out of, and now we have a place in a crystal that has two electrons less than required to satisfy all the bonds, and so this defect can accept two electrons and act as a native double acceptor. And when you think for a moment, when we have the possibility of foreign dopants, donors and acceptors, introducing electrical activity, and native defects on top of that, you can get into quite complex situations. One, for example, is illustrated on the next slide.
Slide 4.
Suppose you want to prepare an n-type conducting zinc sulfide crystal, diffusing in aluminum from a neutral atmosphere. Well, here is the aluminum going in. As we perform the diffusion at some elevated temperature, say 900 degrees or thereabouts, the aluminum will ionize, acquiring a positive charge. Then the lattice will go ahead and eject a zinc, creating a zinc vacancy double acceptor. These two electrons from here now can lower their energy by coming down and filling these double acceptor levels. This defect now has assumed a minus 2 charge. It exerts a Coulombic attraction towards one of the positively charged aluminums, and we form a zinc vacancy aluminum complex, which is now a single acceptor ionized and therefore singly negatively charged. And a distribution of these donor acceptor pairs can take place analogous to the way Dr. Gershenson described donors and acceptors distribute themselves in gallium phosphide, except that in this case we only introduced a donor. The acceptor was created spontaneously, and so our actual objective of obtaining an n-type conducting zinc sulfide failed. All we obtained was an exactly compensated material. Now, in zinc sulfide and zinc selenide, this tendency can be counteracted by subjecting the crystal to a few atmospheres of zinc pressure. This tends to suppress the formation of zinc vacancies, and we can obtain n-type conductivity. In the cadmium compounds, the tendency for the cadmium vacancy formation is much less, and so cadmium sulfide, cadmium selenide can be obtained in n-type form quite easily. Zinc tellurate, on the other hand, is the toughest, as Fischer has shown, 50 to 100 atmospheres of zinc pressure is required to convert it to n-type, and even then, the lowest resistivity obtainable is maybe 1 megaohm centimeter, quite unusable for practical diet fabrication. Now, what determines whether a material compensates or doesn't?
Slide 5.
Well, the next slide shows in simple thermodynamic terms that if the energy required to form the vacancy is relatively small, and the energy liberated by the electron transfer and the association, which is represented by the sum of these terms here, is large, there is every incentive for the material to compensate because the free energy of the system as a whole will be lowered. On the other hand, if it's very expensive to form the vacancy, it will not form, and we do produce extrinsically conducting material. And this is now the important qualitative difference between 2,6 compounds and, say, the 3,5s. In 3,5s, this is too expensive. It's too expensive to form a compensating lattice effect, and so there is no particular difficulty in obtaining them in P or N-type form. In 2,6 compounds, these two terms are either very close to each other, or the term that favors compensation may actually predominate, and we have this compensation process to deal with. Now, quite recently, and by that I mean within a year or perhaps 2 years, we have come to realize that besides the foreign donors and acceptors, the native donors and acceptors and their complexes, we can form some other type of defects in 2,6 compounds, which are sometimes based on Coulombic attraction. Sometimes they are perhaps best described by covalent forces.
Slide 6.
And the next slide shows just a few of these centers which have been proposed. Most of these models are highly sensitive, but I'm showing to you just to show what all you may get into. Diffusing in a simple donor, wanting to achieve nothing but an n-type conducting crystal. If you're lucky, this is what happens. Aluminum or chlorine, both of which can be donors in 2,6 compounds, can diffuse in and produce donor activity and hence n-type conductivity. As I mentioned before, they can form zinc vacancy donor complexes, which act as single acceptors, but then they can also go in, and as Lorenz, Woodbury, and I have discussed in several publications, form double acceptor centers for which these two very, very tentative models have been proposed. In fact, it isn't even quite certain that it is a donor like that, although this is the best candidate. Then in some situations like this one here, chlorine in zinc selenide in the presence of some innocuous divalent impurities can show no electrical or optical activity attributable to this chlorine. It is completely neutralized. It's out of circulation in quantities as high as 2 times 10 to the 19th. And again, these two possibilities have been mentioned. In cadmium telluride, Kravitz has shown that a small amount of iron can complex 6 fluorines, which are also regular donors in 2,6 compounds. And again, your fluorine is taken out of circulation. It doesn't act as a donor. And quite recently, Kingsley has proposed and actually seen complexes between one interstitial donor atom, in which case it would be a triple donor, complexed with 4 acceptors, of all things.
Slide 6A.
Well, as you may guess from this short review of the defect centers that may be produced from a donor, it is quite difficult to even obtain the material in just n-type conductivity, and when you now have a similar list for acceptors and all they can do, and that's what you need to make p-n junction, you can really appreciate the difficulties that one faces in 2,6 compounds. But one can take a more positive view of the situation and say, well, maybe that's an opportunity. Many of these defect centers show very interesting optical and electrical properties, and perhaps some of them can be put to use in practical devices or to exhibit some kind of a new or interesting physical phenomenon. And I'd like to give you an example like that now from the area of injection electroluminescence, where complex defect centers, in fact, we'll probably use this one here, this one here, this one here, and a couple others, have been utilized to produce injection EL in a solid solution system. But before we go into that, let me backtrack a little bit and stress, as Dr. Ivey did, that injection electroluminescence is just one of the few electroluminescent processes that can occur. The type of electroluminescence observed in zinc sulfide powders is maybe injection, it may be avalanching, it may be field extraction of carriers. It's not certain as yet. This is one large field which I'm not going to cover today for time limitations. Another field is the type of diodes as proposed by, pardon me, not diodes, but avalanche structures as proposed by Weiser for gallium arsenide and Moorhead and Crowder for zinc telluride. And there are still others, back-biased p-junctions, heterojunctions, and which people have used at times. But we are going to concentrate on purely injection electroluminescence. Well, I mentioned already that you cannot make a p-junction. Well, what is left over then? What can we do to obtain injection EL in wide bandgap 2/6? Well, three approaches have been used.
Slide 7.
The first one, as shown on the next slide, is based on the solid solution idea. Two such systems have been worked with: the zinc cadmium tellurides by people at IBM, Moorhead, Crowder, Wagner, and late Jerry Mandel have published several papers in this system, and they have found that approximately in a range of 0 to 70% zinc telluride, both p- and n-type conductivity with at the most 1,000 ohm centimeters at room temperature can be obtained. This is the singly cross-hatched region. And when we go to this band gap composition diagram here, you can see that in this doubly cross-hatched region, the three requirements, n-type conductivity, p-type conductivity, and emission in a visible, are simultaneously satisfied, and these diodes emit in a red part of the spectrum, very close to that of the red emission of gallium phosphide. In a zinc selenotelluride system, which had been worked on by Fisher at RCA, Otnet Phillips, and myself, there is a region from 20 to 70% zinc selenite that shows p- and n-type conductivity, and the spectral range accessible in these compositions is corresponds to the red to the green part of the spectrum. Up till now, only red and yellow diodes have been obtained. Now, both of these systems are not producing very good, and by that I mean very efficient emission at room temperature, but at liquid nitrogen, both have been shown to be very efficient, around 10% external quantum efficiency.
Slide 8.
The second approach has been using what might be called a generalized heterojunction structure. Now, many of these have been proposed. They have some features in common, and the next slide will illustrate three of these that people have used. They are illustrated in terms of an n-type semiconductor, but a similar story could be told about p-type, their p-type counterparts. Well, here we have an n-type luminescent semiconductor that presumably cannot be made p-type. To one side of it, we have affixed an ohmic contact, and this ohmic contact can, of course, provide the conduction band of the semiconductor with electrons. If the other side also had an ohmic contact, we would observe just straight transconduction of electrons and obviously no luminescence. So what we have to do on the other side is block the transconduction of electrons somehow so that some holes could be injected in an opposite direction. In the first case, Dr. Ivey mentioned that already, the first so-called inversion layer junction, as proposed by Fisher, uses a metal of a high work function which pulls these bands up, as shown here, and creates here a small region which can at least formally be regarded as p-type, hence the name inversion layer junction. And then when voltage is applied, holes are injected from the metal into the valence band of the semiconductor. The second structure, first proposed by Yaklovic and Lamb, interposes a thin film of a very high material between the electrode here and the semiconductor, hopefully with a larger tunneling barrier for electrons than holes. And again, when you apply voltage, most of the voltage will drop across this region. Some holes can be injected here by tunneling them through the film. The third example is a heterojunction between a low bandgap degeneratively doped p-type material and the n-type semiconductor. It would be fine if we had a wide bandgap p-type semiconductor to use here. However, none have been found that would be crystallographically or chemically compatible with 2,6 compounds. And so the best we can do to use a low bandgap degenerate p-type semiconductor like, say, copper sulfide or selenide. Again, to prevent the transconduction of electrons, we have to do something on the surface here. In this case, we introduce a compensated layer here which retards the transconduction of electrons. Well, I've used the word retarding transconduction many times, and this is where the pitfall lies. In spite of all these heroic efforts here, still about 10,000 electrons go the wrong way for each hole going the right way, amounting to something like 0.1% efficiency. There is one exception, and this is a diode which was described by Moorhead and his associates in zinc telluride, where about 2% efficiency was obtained from a p-type semiconductor to metal contact in the green part of the spectrum. I believe this was done with quite high current densities under pulse conditions. Now, the third approach to injection EL in 2,6 compounds utilizes a self-induced photoconductivity principle and actually doesn't require the material to be either N or P-type.
Slide 9.
And the next slide shows what would be involved. Well, we form a junction, not in a regular sense of a junction, but a generalized junction, from a region in a material that's doped with defect centers which act as electron traps, and the other side doped with defect centers which act as hole traps. Now, what is a hole trap? Well, a hole trap is a defect center like, for example, a double acceptor center, which, when doubly ionized, has a -2 charge, and it, therefore, has a very large capture cross-section for positive holes. After it captures one hole, it's still singly negatively charged, so it has a very small capture cross-section towards the negative charge carriers, the electrons. And so the holes just sit in such a center for a long, long time before they recombine with an electron. And now, if we momentarily illuminate such a junction with bandgap radiation, on this side, electrons will be captured and holes will be left free to conduct current. On this side, the holes will be captured and electrons will be left free to carry current. As you can see, by this way, this insulator is converted into a pseudo-PN junction, and if connected in a forward direction to a battery, it will pass current and emit light, just like a regular PN junction. Now, in spite of sounding sort of far-fetched, a system like that has indeed been demonstrated to work. And it's the same solid solution system that I mentioned in a different connection, but now doped in such a way as to have very high resistivity, its operating temperature, which is liquid nitrogen. This is the zinc selenotelluride system. In the diode, at liquid nitrogen temperature, the resistivity of both the N and P-type sides are between 10 to the 14th and 10 to the 17th ohm centimeters. You can hardly measure any current going through it. Then we momentarily irradiate it with bandgap radiation, and it turns on. And from then on, it will emit light in a self-sustained manner, because as you can see, if a carrier should occasionally get untrapped, there is enough energy available in a junction's own emission to again retrap a carrier. And so the process will continue as long as we keep it at a low temperature.
Slide 10.
The next slide, if I may have all the lights off, will show one of such junctions in operation at 70 degrees Kelvin. This is a little millimeter tube crystal. Its junction area is about 1 square millimeter. And with about as small a current as 10 milliamps going through it, it emits in excess of 10, in a recombination region here, has a brightness of about 10,000 foot lamberts and an external quantum efficiency of 18%, which compares quite favorably with injection EL lasers working in a visible part of the spectrum.
Slide 11.
Now, the defect level structure of this material is shown on the next slide. And it's somewhat complicated, so let's take one center at a time. Here are some deep acceptors, and here are some deep donors, both about the third of an electron volt deep. Now, this depth plus their concentration is such as to give us this 10 to the 14th to 10 to the 17th ohm centimeter resistivity in the dark at liquid nitrogen temperature. Then here are the electron traps, and here are the hole traps. Now, when holes and electrons are produced by the momentary pulse of external light, and the electrons are captured here, the holes that are left saturate these deep acceptors, and the Fermi level moves from here onto these shallow acceptors. And the same presumably happens on the n-type side. In addition to these centers, we have in the space charge region a luminescent level system consisting of two levels having the positions as shown, through which the luminescent process takes place. Well, I would like to conclude my talk by making a few speculative remarks about the future, not only 2-6 compounds, but 3-5s or any other material alike. We are witnessing today a growing trend towards miniaturization and multifunctional design in electronic circuits. This is evidenced most clearly by the integrated circuit approach to electronics. Now, in most integrated circuits, the active nonlinear components are still PNP or NPN transistors. Now, a transistor, as far as the defect centers are concerned, is a very simple device. All it needs is shallow acceptors and donors for its operation. Where the sophistication comes in a way they are put together, coupled with the various linear and passive elements in a small single chip of, say, silicon or germanium. So what I would like to propose now is a different kind of multifunctional design approach, where not arrays of p-n junctions, but groups of defect centers having different electro-optical properties are used to carry out the different sub-tasks of the device as a whole. In that, it might be perhaps likened to a primitive organism where differentiated cells are carrying on different tasks so that the organism as a whole may live. And this junction which you saw here is perhaps a very, very simple example of such a multifunctional device using differentiated cells or defect centers in the present case. As you saw, we had centers which emitted light, centers which absorbed light, centers that took care of the n-type or p-type conductivity, centers that stored either n-type or p-type charge carriers.
Slide 11A.
And so I feel that as our understanding of more complex defect centers increases, we'll be seeing more and more of this sort of approach where the ability of a solid to carry electrical current is suitably coupled to optical, acoustical, or magnetic properties. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Dr. Avin?
Weisberg, RCA, you talked about external quantum efficiencies of 18%. Would you care to comment on what the power efficiency was, or rather, how much voltage was required to drive the diode?
The power efficiency is about a tenth of that. We lose 90% of our power in the contact to the p-type side. It's a very, very bad contact. This remark applies to these self-photoconducting diodes. Now, the other breed of zinc-selenide telluride junctions, which we have come upon quite recently, in fact, since the Durham meeting, some of you heard me there, are more power efficient. They do not require the turn on light. They are perhaps 2% power efficient or 3%.
Any other questions?
Evans from Picatinny Arsenal. Would you comment, please, on the possibility of perhaps doping the 2-6 compounds by ion implantation or ion bombardment or creating defect centers?
We are very much interested in this approach and in preliminary stages in carrying it out. You may have heard from a group at SERL in England that is using exactly this approach to bombard zinc selenide with phosphorus, which presumably is a shallow acceptor, it is a thing to try. What you have to consider, of course, is that you may have to anneal out the damage produced by the impacts, and then you may again thermalize your material and create the same vacancies and lattice defects that you hope to get away from.
You have just seen and heard a tape slide talk, Defect Chemistry and Injection Electroluminescence in Wide Band Gap 2-6 Compounds, presented by Dr. Manuel Avin, General Electric Research Laboratories, Schenectady, New York, at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers Basic Sciences Committee Seminar on May 11, 1966, at the Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. Thank you.